Wait, you mean another one has The Shining? In honor of Dr. Sleep, who's your favorite movie doctor?
I'm Matt Patches, and no, I will not say Patch Adams. I'm going to go with Dr. Zaius from Planet of the Apes.
I'm David the Seven, and I'm going with Steve Martin's dentist in Little Shop of Horrors, because I watched that sequence recently, and recency bias is real.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and you know what? I'm going rogue. I cannot betray my heart in this case, even though if I did, Dr. Peter Benton, a VR fame, could certainly perform life-saving surgery on me. I mean, what can you say about Peter Benton, the greatest doctor in any medium in history?
Not a movie.
It doesn't matter. You know what? He transcends your petty definitions of what media is.
Some people consider ER to be one long movie.
And I am one of them. He's bigger than TV, bigger than movies, bigger than us all. Peter Benton, Eric LaSalle, the god. What a man.
I should have concurred.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room number 278 for the week of Wednesday, November 6, 2019. And on this day, in a lot of years, a bunch of presidents were elected because it's, you know, November 6th. But who cares? In 1973, this was the first day of principal photography on The Man with the Golden Gun, the James Bond movie.
Not a very good James Bond movie, to be quite honest.
Not the best. Well, it owes a lot to, what is it, Treasure Island?
No, Fantasy Island?
The pilot. Fantasy Island, yeah. Which, you know, is a weird basis for a James Bond film. But why not? It was the 70s. And
it gave us a very cool gun in GoldenEye, the NCAA.
Yes.
That's
the real legacy.
And, Katie Rich will be joining us later in the podcast, but if you listen to the end of every podcast recently, we've been putting some little snippets from Charlie, who is refusing to go to bed as we are recording.
A dire warning to me about my future life with children.
Yeah, don't give your kid chocolate right before bedtime. Good lesson.
God. It's the post-Halloween blues at the Rich House. But until then, David, do we have any reviews this week?
I believe we do. We have three new reviews, and I will read them to you now. Let's start with Jake from Reno, who says, I love your podcast. 5 stars. Dear Dave N. Patches, I choose to read that as Madame Patches, Dave 7, and Katie. I know you like listener mail / reviews, so here goes. My wife introduced me to your podcast a while ago, but only listening while video gaming, leaving me likely too distracted. Hold that thought, Jake from Reno. We'll come back on the video game topic later this episode. But recently, on one of our routine, fun Reno to Sacramento drives over the Sierras this October, I finally listened and wish to express my opinion on how amazing you all are. I've been binging on your podcast ever since. I especially love your Quarter Quells, my favorite storytelling. Please do a part two. I'm sure you all have second storytelling movie stories. I wish to add that I think part of the charm, not oft or ever recognized, is the tonal and frankly lovely quality of all of your voices. You know, I feel like Jake from Reno just wanted to speak to the lovely mellifluousness of three of the hosts of this show's voices, and then thought it would be too cruel to exclude me. And so he lumped my nasal disaster in. Oh, I fucking hate my voice so much.
Why do you hate your voice? I mean, it's like listening to Larry David.
I was going to say mainly because it's a vehicle for the words that
it's like listening to the young Bernie Sanders Chronicles.
Of course, the main draw is your insightful observations. I'm looking at you, Mr. Patches. Oh, Jesus, this review has gotten off the rails. And witty banter and friendship that keep me tuned in. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Jake from Reno. No, Jake from Reno, thank you. This review was very helpful. Mostly because
you know what this review actually made me wonder
this week, and now I'm less afraid to listen to them. What are you saying, Patches?
Can you answer a question for me, David? You would know this. This review made me wonder, did the guy who made Man from Reno a few years back, ever make another movie. That was a good neo-noir.
His name is Dave Boyle. It is a very good noir. And I believe that he has been working on a number of different things, none of which have come to fruition, at least not of the feature film variety. I'm buddies with him on Facebook. I see him update from time to time.
He directed Surrogate Valentine with Go Nakamura. I didn't even realize that.
Of course, yeah, that was before that. And he also directed the sequel. I think he's working on getting another feature made. One of these days, fingers crossed. Megadeth of Superman says, huge fan, wannabe Journo. Hey, Fighting in the War Room crew, love the show. It is a quintessential part of my pop culture diet. I look forward to it every week, whether it's a strange Eddie from Patches.
Excuse me?
This is where you're supposed to say Eddie in your Venom voice.
Oh, Eddie! Sorry. I don't immediately respond to the name Eddie as a.
You move to New Jersey and suddenly everything falls apart. Katie's enthusiasm for classic musicals. Dave Seven bringing context to streaming and superhero content when Patches or David get fatalistic. Or Martin Scorsese, if I may interject. Or David genuinely asking himself, was this review helpful? I also wanted to take this opportunity to exploit the We Will Read This Live on the Air concept and ask you all a question. I'm a student who's getting close to graduating, and my dream job is to write film criticism and entertainment journalism. I feel like I should stop you right there, but I'll let you keep going. My question to y'all is how you got started and what you found to be the most helpful thing you've learned as the medium has changed over the years. I look forward to hearing back. Thanks so much. I really appreciate what you all do. Take care. Now, before we answer this could be a potential quarterquel in the future. We can all give a very short answer before elaborating on a future episode. I wrote for my college newspaper and then picked up some very, small news items for a very kind editor and friend, a good person we all know, Eric Davis, who then nurtured my willingness and enthusiasm and was able to do it from there. And I didn't have huge amounts of college debt, and my privilege is a big part of why I was able to get started and now work a series of low-paying jobs. And now it's coming to really bite me, especially as I start a family. Patches?
Well, the question was, how did we stumble into this? Is that
how we get started? Yeah.
Well, in college, I spent one of my summer jobs sophomore year was assistant directing a feature film directed by occasional guest Jordan Hoffman. Oddly enough, and everyone should watch that movie. It's called Body Antibody. I'm still very proud of it. I haven't watched it in many years, but we worked our asses off to make that movie. And I was just a kid when I met Jordan. He was an NYU alum. We connected. He got a job at UGO, Hearst owned property. I started reviewing DVDs for him, and then one thing led to another. It was crazy. I would suggest people just write. That's
one thing always always leads to another, and
momentum. I heard Deadspin's looking for writers.
Consistency, get doing regular solid grunt work for people and for money until they give you an opportunity to do slightly more exciting work also for money.
You should definitely start the grunt work, because I went to school for screenwriting, but then reviewed porn DVDs and then gossip blogged, and then eventually they trusted me to talk about movies because presumably I had a screenwriting background.
Who's they?
They, whatever the company that owned ComingSoon.net's family of things. So I went from...
Wait, you reviewed the porn DVDs for ComingSoon.net or their sister site, ComingSoon.net?
I reviewed the porn DVDs for SecHerald.com. That proved that I could basically write about like anything that I used for a celebrity site that just needed 99 posts a day. They didn't care what it was about.
That's a lot of posts.
From that celebrity site called Hollywood.tv, I got picked up by a site called The Bad and Ugly, which was owned by that group of people. I Don't Like You in That Way, which is owned by that group of people. And then eventually they allowed me to do some work for Coming Soon, which got me into movies. And,
I've been in this line of work for about 10 years, and I still feel like I'm working towards reviewing porn DVDs. So we all have our own journeys. Megadeth of Superman, I know it's a really hard question to answer. There is no really satisfying way of doing it in short order. We all get asked this frequently, and we are still looking for the answers ourselves in some respects. But I would love to be able to elaborate on this a little bit further in a future episode. And so maybe we will, but keep writing. get yourself out there. Hopefully good things will happen. And this review, very helpful, of course. And finally, a quick review from H.C. Oh, I see. It's an anagram of my last name. H-C-I-L-R-H-E. And then D-I-V-H.
I showed you all the clues.
Oh, not even an anagram. It is just my name backwards. The capital letters threw me off. Anyway, Hickle Ray Divad says, hey. Hello, I am David Ehrlich. I like to bunk the beepo, mama, bunk the beepo, oh yeah.
Is this a Pink Fong Baby Shark spinoff song? What is this?
I don't know. I am choosing to see it as a Death Stranding tie-in because of the use of the word mama, and BB. Well, mama was the one that jumped out to me, which will come back later. So I'd say this review is very helpful in teeing up our conversation about Death Stranding.
Perfect.
Spoiler alert.
Please do leave us a review on iTunes, Fighting in the War Room. They are incredibly valuable to us. They're the best way of growing our show. We will read them live on air and often for the first time. And that can cause problems or lovely moments. Who knows? Either one way or the other, we'd love to hear from you. Please leave us reviews.
This week, not a whole lot comes out. Dr. Sleep comes out, the sequel to The Shining. Apple TV shows are still happening. You don't want to start that early, David. Wait until you get there. Not a whole lot comes out, but one, the most blockbuster moment, I think, of the week is actually a video game. One entitled Death Stranding. If you have heard of this game, you know why people are very excited. And if you haven't, it's definitely worth us, our podcast, digging into this because, the creator of the game, Hideo Kojima, extreme fan of movies. There's a reason that Guillermo del Toro and Nicholas Winding Refn appear in Death Stranding. There's a ton of actors. It's a very cinematic game. Norman Reedus from Walking Dead appears in this game. Mads Mikkelsen, Lea Seydoux, Margaret Qualley. Tons of people are in
Laura
this
Wagner,
game.
Bionic Wagner, the Bionic Woman herself.
Yes, Kojima loves Bionic Woman. Kojima being the creator of Metal Gear series, most famously, other kind of RPGs over the years. He's always had this habit. I just remember reading like Game Pro in the mid-90s and into the late 90s, and just people kind of ragging on Kojima for wanting to make movies or his elaborate cutscenes in Metal Gear games, and people kind of slapping him on the wrist for that. That was not what gamers were looking for at the time. And oddly enough, Death Stranding might be the biggest release of the year, at least in terms of anticipation. This game has been teased by Kojima online for years and years, and no one knew what the hell it was going to be about until pretty much like 2 weeks ago when the game was released to press for them to play. But the trailers have been super oblique. There's babies attached to chests, and Norman Reedus plays this guy wearing futuristic armor who runs around fields and builds bridges. And Kojima has described this game as being part of the new genre called the Strand genre. And at the end of the segment, I really want to know if there's any movies that fall into the Strand genre. I implore people before digging into our conversation here, definitely watch the trailers for Death Stranding. If you haven't, maybe.
Well, I would strongly advise you to not watch.
Blind.
No, you're welcome to watch the trailers. I would not watch the 7.5 minute launch
super
day trailer.
Right.
Which spoils literally starts with the ending of the game.
I sent that to Katie because I did not think that she will ever play Death Stranding.
Right. So but if, Katie has made that clear, but in the event that you are Death Stranding curious, I would not start there.
Here's my question. David, you got a chance to play this game. You actually emailed me trying to get in touch with Kojima. It was really great. I had the power. I felt like I could connect you to the gaming world.
No, you did. You connected me with the right press contact, and for the first time in
I
my
felt,
film writing career, I reviewed a video game.
Reviewed a video game that you have called the best video game movie of all time. But before we get into like the nitty gritty about,
we need to lay some groundwork.
I really want to know. I mean, the big question here for me is like, what? I don't want to say what is Death Stranding about. Maybe that's the wrong question, but I am curious because we've seen so much imagery of Norman Reedus' character running around and having these projectile things and like fighting ghosts. I don't know what's going on, but the whole Stranding element, Kojima has said, you know, he wants to bring people together here around the world and create strands and stop building walls and create communication. What is Death Stranding? What's the deal with Death Stranding?
I am all too happy to answer that question. Thank you. And Dave, this segment may run a little bit longer than 10 minutes. That's okay, because we're killing time for Katie to come back and join us. Okay, where to begin? Death Stranding. I think it would be helpful to talk about the plot before we sort of get into it, but I think Pat just kicked us off on a really great idea, which is the idea of connectivity. So Death Stranding is a post-apocalyptic open-world game. It's built off the engine of this game Horizon Zero Dawn. It's an open world game in the sense of Grand Theft Auto, Red Dead Redemption, Zelda, Breath of the Wild.
But firmly in the Strand genre, as we've established.
Firmly in the Strand genre. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic world, but not actually more specifically than that. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic America where something has happened called the Death Stranding. And the Death Stranding Kojima's imagination, as anyone knows who's played his previous games, is voracious and expansive, and his games can be a pseudo educational experience in their own right. And Death Stranding is what they call it when whales beach themselves. In the parlance of this game, a Death Stranding is what happened when one day there were a series of extinction level explosions across, well, we think the world, we really don't know. Really, as far as we know, the United States, because communication was so completely cut off that the world beyond our borders sort of ceased to exist for the people in this country, where everyone shit just went nuts. And suddenly the world was plagued by these invisible monsters called BTs, and a rain called Timefall, which acts like acid rain in a way. When it hits your skin, it seems to have that effect. But what it's really doing is aging any metal or organic material it touches so rapidly that it seems to be like acid rain, but is in fact something very different. And that has had a profound effect on pretty much everything in the world. It's made building very difficult. All of the surviving people in America have retreated into underground bunkers and have become very, very afraid of going outside. And so whenever you interact with people, it tends to be holograms of themselves, very lifelike holograms that they are projecting from their place underground. Your job as Sam Strand is as essentially a futuristic Amazon employee, a post-apocalyptic Amazon employee. You are the postman of the Kevin James variety. Your job is to bring packages to people, but really you're moving from east to west, from one seaboard to another, to reconnect America and, I quote, make America whole again. And this game is very much about an America, and there are explicit references to Donald Trump's presidency and the state of mind of this country and everything that's happening at this particular point in time, even though the game takes place several generations into the future, where, you know, fractiousness between people and violence and consuming and so on have sort of led to the state that Death Stranding then exacerbated greatly. And it's sort of reckoning with the isolation and the loneliness that people feel from themselves, from one another. And over the course of the game, you are quite literally bringing people together. It starts by just delivering stuff, but you have a very direct influence on the lives of the characters that you meet. And you also, in an interactive or sort of network-friendly touch that expands on an idea that I think was really put into popular use in the Dark Souls games, while it is a single-player game, you can see occasionally other players in your game, and you can 100% see and interact with the structures that they build and leave behind. So it starts off, because so much of the game is walking and walking around this desolate world, which is meant to be like post-apocalyptic Baltimore, but really looks like, you know, photorealistically like Iceland, like the black beaches and green craggy landscape of Iceland. And you are, you need to climb a hill, you'll build a ladder, and then another player can come along and use that ladder. Later, you're building timefall shelters and post office boxes where you can store things for people and bridges and things like that. And you can, when you see these from another player, you can like them because likes, not of the Facebook proprietary nature, but of a sort of affirmation in an online way, are the currency in this game. You can't spend them. You have an infinite array of them, but the only value is that which you are given from other people. It sort of just becomes your experience points, but it is a really affirmative thing of you, just giving positive reinforcement to people and sort of building a nice core element, if you will.
I like that you started this bit with the thing. Let's talk about the plot a little bit.
It's a very complicated game. It's one of those games where...
Who does Mads Mikkelsen play?
All right. So you know, Norman Reedus is this guy. Who Mads Mikkelsen plays is not revealed for about 55 of the 60 hours in the game.
Spoilerish. Oh, Jesus.
But you see him quite a lot. Lea Seydoux plays a sort of femme fatale named Fragile, who she is not far removed from her Bond performance. Margaret Qualley plays maybe my favorite character named Mama, to go back to our review segment, who is sort of the Q of this world. She is sort of a tech nut. I mean, one of the things with all that sort of nice core unification element is that you can't kill people in this game. I mean, you can, but you really don't want to because... those monsters are essentially what happens when, well, I don't want to get into it, but you really can't afford for people to die. If you kill someone who's trying to kill you, it's much, 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 much worse than simply tranquilizing them. And Metal Gear Solid games, you know, there's a reason why the most popular tool in those games is a cardboard box. Hideo Kojima, as I wrote about at length for New Wire today, has always been interested in using the violent mechanics of video games to subvert them and sort of make them elements of inclusivity, to use them as a way of bringing people together rather than pushing them apart. He talks a lot about what Kobo Abe wrote as the rope and the stick, and people tend to use video game controllers as a stick, and he loves to reappropriate them as ropes. And so sometimes you are literally using ropes in this game. You are using bola guns to trip over the cargo-obsessed, the package-obsessed mules, who are one of the bad guy groups. But there is a very, 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 very elaborate plot that comes up that ends in a cutscene that I believe, I don't want to say it's longer than The Irishman. I was sort of joking when I made that reference to the piece that I wrote, but it's not as far away as you might think. You know, he loves to fuck with players, and he continues to do that. And the story gets so insane, it's so up its own ass in terms of its jargon, but is rendered so beautifully and with such great emotion and so beautifully well directed. I mean, Kojima has always wanted to be a film director. That was his initial ambition, but I think he moved away from that medium because he was hoping to do something that could grab people by the lapels a little bit more and bring them forward. Using similar technology as Andy Serkis used in the Planet of the Apes films, he has directed, and other games have done this, but never this well. He's directed these motion capture performances, paved right over the uncanny valley. I mean, the conversation around Gemini Man and The Irishman feels, I don't know if quaint, but certainly not as advanced as what he's doing here. He's playing into an all-digital world is obviously very different than trying to layer digital elements into a real live-action world. But seeing these performances, seeing what Margaret Qualley does in this one scene, it's like so incredibly moving and expressive and real. And then, of course, there's BB, the baby who you carry the entire game, the 7-month-old fetus. Who can sense the invisible
Norman
monsters.
Fetus.
Right. He can sense the invisible monsters. You carry him the whole game. I loved Ellie in The Last of Us. And when I was, you know, 14, I guess I liked Aerith or was moved by her death. But I've never really had a game foster an emotional connection with a character the way that this game does with little BB, and it's very well done. Yes.
Let me ask you something, because I feel like we could talk about this game for hours.
For hours.
So much to the visuals
Death Stranding
and so much of the plot.
Podcast. New podcast.
But to wrap up, I'm wondering, you played through the whole game, hours and hours and hours and hours of this game, and I believe it's in like different chapters. That
and
are
18
in,
minutes.
What was there an experience, a sequence, something in the game that you found either profound or startling? Or is there a very specific moment that you think is emblematic of why this game's working on a different level?
Well, I think what's so interesting about this game, which is sort of, you know, there will be a lot, it will be divisive. There, it is a game that really does come down to walking long distances and balancing your character, trying to avoid getting stuck in deep water or getting spotted by things, cargo management. I mean, these are things that I found very rewarding, but it will be trying for people. But what I really responded to was how the cinematic elements of the game strengthened the interactive portions of it, and the interactive portions of it strengthened the movie-like portions of it as well. I mean, the feeling of responsibility that you have for BB makes the story resonate that much stronger. And the expressiveness that you see from these cutscenes, which are long and many, really adds fascinating layers to and very sort of interactive and visceral layers to the experience of putting this world back together and then facing really just like the value of even doing that when extinction on a cosmic timescale, if it doesn't happen today, will happen a couple minutes down the road for humankind, and sort of just wrestling with the value of being alive. It's very depressive game. It did remind me, I mean, I've compared it mostly, you know, to go with Kojima's cinematic references to an Andrei Tarkovsky film. I mean, there are parts you're walking down this road and this time fall is falling on you, and the road is being the bits of concrete are floating up into the sky. But it also reminded me in more of this sphere a little bit of Neon Genesis Evangelion and wrestling with a lot of the themes that that game does, or that movie does, or show. I'm going to use every wrong word to describe it. But it's End of Evangelion. Well, and it has not been a game. Well, it has. Maybe it's been a game. Probably has been a game. But End of Evangelion, which is a movie, is really the most direct reference that I found in a game that is brimming with them. The performances are wonderful. Guillermo del Toro, Nicholas Winding Refn, Edgar Wright, and Jordan Vogt Roberts are all in the game, although none of them actually play their roles. They're all just lending their likenesses. But the people who inhabit their bodies with their voices do it so well that after a couple of minutes, you completely forget what they actually sound like. And Conan O'Brien is in the game, which was a lovely surprise. Game, yeah. Anyway, it's a fascinating game. I really encourage you to read about it, not on Polygon.com because they completely got it wrong. But if you go to IndieWire, you can read the article that I wrote.
We liked it. What are you talking about?
You said he was trying to make Fetch happen. Wait, did he like it? Am I confusing you with some other album?
No, that we liked it, but we also said that. Okay, so Death Stranding, it comes out on Friday, and it actually comes to PC in the spring. So if you don't have a PlayStation, you can watch this. And for the final word, Katie, any thoughts on Death Stranding?
Hey, I'm here now. David, did you know that video games are for fucking nerds?
I'll say to you what I said to Jordan Hoffman when he said the same thing. Okay, boomer.
I'm just an aged millennial who never advanced beyond Super Nintendo. I suggested, oh, by the way, I'm still here now. Thanks for waiting for me. I suggested talking about Dickinson because I watched one episode of this Apple TV Plus show after basically hearing that that was the only one that anybody really liked that much from the batch of shows that debuted on Apple. And I found it kind of fine and kind of obnoxious in the way that it's like the all the scenes in Walk Hard where they're like, I can't believe I'm here in India with you, John Lennon.
Wait, what does that mean? What do you mean by that?
A lot of people looking at her being like, Emily Dickinson, you have such talent. Or then her father being like, you'll bring shame upon the name Dickinson. And you're like, okay, I see.
That's the name of the show.
I see what we're doing here. Or like, that's the name of a famous poet. What? I find Haley Steinfeld pretty charming, but I don't know. I had a trouble like getting on its wavelength in that way. I've heard that it gets over kind of the pilotiness and maybe gets a little bit less obvious as it goes on. I don't know. Do you guys want to get convince me to keep watching, even though I didn't like the first episode that much?
Well, as a pilot, could you, as someone who hasn't watched it, could you give me the very obvious premise that it sets up in this pilot
episode? It's basically about Emily Dickinson, as a, not a teenager, I guess a young woman in her 20s, living, you know, like a regular person, like fairly wealthy person in Amherst at this time, but also writing poems. And her best friend, who she's having a lesbian affair with, is getting married to her brother, which she's not that into. I don't really get it, because it feels like if you're having an illicit affair with your friend, you should want her to marry into the family, because then she'll be around all the time. And her father doesn't want her publishing poems. She wants to publish poems, and that's, I don't know, that's about it, right?
That
Emily
is,
Dickinson, you've heard of her.
That's about it.
Katie, can you answer? Can you just answer a question for me? I find the existence of this show to be very amusing, but you know, the thing about Emily Dickinson, of course, is that she was a bit of a shut-in. She, as we saw in Terrence Davies' divisive but spectacular quiet passion, she didn't really get out of the house much. How do they basically, like, at its essence, tweak her story to suit a CW adjacent kind of show?
Oh, because she talks like she's on a CW show. I mean, as her story, it's like, I mean, it's about her like having ambition. Well, that's being quelled.
She's
like,
also imagining herself, you know, she is suppressed by, yeah, she's suppressed by her dad, played by Toby Huss, aka Artie, the strongest man in the world. And then she imagines herself getting in a carriage pulled by ghost horses. Wiz Khalifa plays Death, and they flirt. That's all in the pilot. So she's kind of just imagining her way out of her solitary nature. But yeah, she also has this kind of sexual relationship happening in you know, off the beaten path. So
is this like Romeo plus Juliet type of like period but not storytelling?
It doesn't seem that stylish.
Kind of. It's not as stylish as Romeo and Juliet. It's more like in the dialogue where she's just like, this totally sucks, Mom. I don't want to get the water. And like all the other women are like all tied up in, you know, social mores at the time. She's like, no, I just want to write poems and be myself.
Does she call anyone a basic bitch?
Not yet.
Did she tell anyone, okay, boomer?
Thank God, no.
Wow.
I mean, compared to all the other shows, especially Morning Show, which is obviously getting the most attention of all these Apple shows, which, and the show is so staid and trashy. All of these shows, to me, having watched bits of, you know, the first few episodes of all of them, they're kind of all like airport novel versions of Better Things. But I do think Dickinson stands out because of Haley Steinfeld. But my big question to you, Katie, as someone who loves Little Women,
who has not seen the movie.
Who has not seen the movie. No, I'm talking, you are hype for Little Women, the movie.
Hype
but
for Little Women.
You seem
sure
to be a fan of the book, I would assume, based on your hype. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
But so what is it about this era, or what is it about, because I think they're taking Emily Dickinson's story and turning it into not exactly what a traditional like Jane Eyre adaptation would be or a Little Women adaptation would be, but there's something to that, right? Like they're turning Emily Dickinson's story into YA period fiction.
Yeah.
Or
I don't hate the idea of it.
I'm just wondering if it's masquerading as that, or is it doing a good job of tapping into why young women would want to see this story told in this way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know. It does feel like it's a weird fit for it because Emily Dickinson famously like didn't really leave her house and wasn't appreciated in her time. So I don't know how, if you're trying to like put a female empowerment narrative onto her, how you succeed in that, given the way that her life ended in real life. I guess that's what the show is going to do. I guess I kind of get Little Women and why you would like want it to feel fresh and modern for a new time, because a lot of those characters still feel fresh and modern. You have Jo, you have someone who's like kind of pushing against the boundaries of what the time asked of her. There's not a lot of evidence that Emily Dickinson did that necessarily, and it feels a little bit more grafted on, but I'm not an Emily Dickinson expert and I've only watched one episode, so
there you go. Here's my
should
I know
I
this
keep
is
watching?
I don't know, there's a lot of someone tweeted today that there's like 45 new television shows coming out in November, so I'm not sure.
Like 65.
Oh god. So maybe you might be right, but I know this is our mini segment, but I do have one weirder question that Dickinson spurred. What do you think is the cap for taking someone's real life and making it CW-ified. How far back do you need to go? Do they need to be dead? You couldn't do like J.K. Rowling, young J.K. Rowling, fucking and talking about witches, right? Like, what's the cap?
Enough.
What's the cap?
I think if it's someone who's famous, like, you know, like there was a there's been talk forever about doing like a young Hillary Clinton like movie about like what it was like for her in the Watergate investigation. I feel like she's famous enough that you can kind of do whatever you want with her real life and it doesn't necessarily affect them improperly.
I feel like the cap is their work. I mean, especially if we're talking about writers, is their work in the public domain? And in Emily Dickinson's case, the answer would be yes.
Yeah, or are they a big enough public figure that you could do a primary colors of them and not have to, you know, pay the rights to use their name? But I would say, yeah, I want to do the Riverdale Edgar Allan Poe series. Hook me up.
Yeah.
He's really sad, guys, and he doesn't have any friends. And
wait, isn't this Patches cue to quote
Emily?
I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
I think about it all the time.
Good episode for Patches quotes.
Your own personal Jesus.
So guys, in the category of Dave saw the movie, we could now place two movies from this upcoming weekend. We could put Terminator Dark Fate. Was Patches right? Was David right? Neither of them was really right. It was some good moments with a lot of bland moments.
But no, the Terminator revisionism that's already coming in because of the film's low box office is horrifying.
I'm not a revisionist.
It's a terrible movie.
I liked it before it bumped.
Ugh, God.
It wasn't the war crime on the Terminator franchise that I was dreading it could be. Maybe I was properly calibrated by the podcast.
Go.
But the other...
Is it the end of the Terminator franchise?
No.
Real quick. No?
No. No, it'll be a streaming series eventually, but it's probably the end of its movie franchise.
As long as the Ellison family owns the Terminator franchise, it will probably pop up somewhere else again. And you know what? James Cameron will probably say that next one's perfectly fine, too. Anyway, not important. The other movie that I saw this weekend was Parasite. I finally got to see the old Palme d'Or winner at Alamo Drafthouse. It was not easy because Parasite is selling out even here in the middle of America. I know we've talked about it because Katie, you saw it at TIFF, right? And David also saw it at TIFF?
I think David
saw it.
I saw it again. All right.
I'm a fancy boy.
Two festival screenings. Parasite is a movie with a lot of twists, and I think it's a very well constructed film. So we've held off until it's actually in theater that you guys can see it to talk about Parasite the film, including like stuff in its end and past its midpoint.
So we should bring spoiler gone.
Yeah. Right off the bat, we're definitely going full spoilers here because the twists are where it's at.
Yeah, go see Parasite. Come back, listen to this segment. If you have been fortunate enough to catch screening of Parasite, welcome.
Before we launch in, I want to push back slightly. Not that I'm objecting to the spoiler gong and doing this for people who have seen the movie, but that narrative about don't spoil the end game has been attached to Parasite since that Cannes screening when Bong Joon-ho sent critics a letter saying, please don't spoil the movie. And we're now in spoiler territory, so I'm comfortable to say, but please don't spoil, you know, what happens after the brother or the son, rather, like gets his sister a job. Like that was the cutoff point for him.
Wow, it's really early in the movie.
It's pretty early. I mean,
I think it's been good for this movie because I know a lot of people who are still being like, I've heard Parasite is good, but I'm scared of horror movies. That seems really successful to me because no one knows what the fuck this movie's about.
I do, you know, listen, I'm all for framing the movie however you need to get butts in the seats when it comes to daring, bold, new cinema. The Trojan horse approach is totally fine by me. But I do think that the plot twistiness of this movie has been seriously overstated.
You're in the critics bubble on this one. I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure that we focus more on what the movie's doing than
we're going
to
talk about
how it hides.
Well, I mean, I guess to have a real conversation about it, you have to be able to.
We're
talk
being
about
fair
it.
To yeah. our listeners.
I did the thing where I read the plot summary before I saw the movie, because you know why I.
That's what you
were
do.
Talking about Parasite. I didn't get to see Parasite. That's my the way my life tugs my Googling. But that being said, the execution of the actual plot, makes it a great movie. The thing that I read was just like, oh, that's interesting. But like the actual moments of the reveals, you know, the old maid screaming honey as she like runs down into a dark chamber. We have no idea where it goes is like the, what those moments make this movie great. It's a movie I haven't felt that I could watch like a family just go about their day, like you watch these two families go about their day since like Roma. And even though those are two very different movies, they're both very purposefully constructed movies, in a way where I almost think like that's, what makes them, stand out in the oeuvre of their respective, directors. The amount of control Parasite has over its own story is kind of amazing to me, to the point that I think I'm still processing it, like a day and a half later. So I want to throw to somebody like Katie or David that has had a lot of time to process Parasite.
Katie, I have a question for you, because I think when you saw this at Toronto, you walked out and I saw you tweet, because this is your beat. You talked about that you thought Parasite was really transcendent in a way that you thought everyone was going to be blown back in their chairs about this. Everyone could be talking about the Oscars and Parasite going all the way. It's like really one of the best movies of the year. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was that basically?
I don't remember if I tweeted about that, but yes, I do feel that way.
I feel like that. Yeah, that sentiment came out. And I'm wondering, you know, I've read a bunch of interviews with Bong Joon-ho. There's a lot of specific Korean culture in this movie, and a lot of people were worried about that translating. But I'm wondering what you think, at what moment during this movie do you think everyone's going to get this, everyone's going to love this, and that obviously has, but I wonder when the movie kind of starts clicking for you. Is it like...
Probably when the scheme begins, right? Like when you realize the extent to which this family is all banding together to pull one over on these rich people. Like the idea of a heist movie is extremely American and universal, I think. You know, the movie is about class warfare, which is something that we talk about in the United States all the time, that American movies are all about. And yeah, there's definitely plenty of like Korean culture elements to it that, you know, as someone who likes seeing foreign movies, it's interesting to like get a glimpse into other people's cultures, but also, you know, just family dynamics. Like that stuff is pretty easy to translate. And then it's just fun. Like it's just really not an eat your vegetables Palme d'Or winner at all, which I think we all know some of them can be. It's never boring. It feels so precisely made. Like even the design of the house that they're all in, like if you like real estate porn the way that I do, you just kind of want to spend time wandering around this fancy ass house that was built by scratch for this movie. And I think, not that I was the first person to say that Parasite would like be a hit with audiences, but I think I've been right. Like it's been a huge specialty box office hit. It played really well at festivals. It does have this universality that I think, you know, most great movies do. I'm right.
No, I think you are right. And I think for me that the movie started working at a different level from the very beginning. Like I'm glad that the plight of this family is specific. You really like all the sets in this movie are built from the ground up, and I think they need to be. We need to feel the movie really only takes place in two places, this gorgeous house, but they're tiny cramped apartment in their tiny cramped neighborhood and street that eventually gets completely flooded and you realize just how claustrophobic the whole thing is. But when we meet them and they're trying to find cell signal in their apartment, I mean, every single part of their lives is such a struggle when they're all folding pizza boxes. I think Bong Joon-ho does a really good job of not making it full of grief and not like cranking the wheel where it feels just pain and everything is awful. It's not the kind of, it's not miserableism. It's, everyday life they're getting by, and they've become content with the poverty that they're living in. But they don't seem diabolical either.
Or
so when
resigned
they,
to.
Yeah, when they end up launching into the heist, it's even more surprising because they're not diabolical people, right? They figured out how to be crafty. They're not Danny Ocean, and they're not con people at heart, I don't think, unless there's something that I'm missing that would have made them higher caliber thieves and con people. But then they slip into this so naturally because they must take this opportunity. They must make all the money and weasel their way in. They're good people. And it's interesting to see pretty good people pull something off and kind of be corrupted by it. I think that's what really, by the end of the movie, had my pit in my stomach, or just like, everything's going to go wrong here. They made a bad decision. But at what point in the movie does it feel like a bad decision? I guess that's the twist when we discover what's at the bottom of the mansion.
Oh, but it's the minute they send the housekeeper away, you're like, oh, she's not done. Like, you know that somehow is going to come back to get them.
When they peach her.
Yeah, I mean, that sequence of them poisoning her with the peach is so satisfying, but she's presented as so competent that you know something's going to happen. I mean, and Dave was talking about, like, when she runs down to the basement not knowing what's going to happen. The moment for me is when you're turning the corner to see what she's doing down there, and you see her wedged in with, like, between the shelving unit and the wall trying to open up the secret door, and it was just so not what I thought was going to happen. I kind of did think it was going to be a horror movie. I wasn't prepared for what it was going to be. I was really bracing for impact, and that was so funny and so, like, the last thing I expected to see. It was thrilling.
Well,
like,
I think
the reason that you don't want to know what's going to happen, because you have no clue
right,
that's going to be
right.
I think what's interesting about that character and the way you're describing her, the housekeeper who they get fired, is it's sort of the engine of capitalism at work on a moral scale, because what happens is that they sort of assign her this adversarial role because she is standing between them and scheming more money for themselves than what they can earn. And we align ourselves with them because the movie is about them and we're rooting for their scheme already. And we begin to think of this perfectly nice, competent woman who's just doing her best to make a living. And as far as we know at that point, and really at all points, but certainly at that point, we see her as an obstacle to be defeated. And that is sort of the way that the system that Parasite is critiquing has trained us all to think. It's the most natural thing in the world. It's second nature. You don't really even begin to process it. And the character assumes a sort of insidious element to her, to the point when she returns and you see her face in the security camera, mm-hmm. it's already streaked with all sorts of dark thoughts and things that you, that sort of bubbles to the surface because, not only have we already projected them onto her, but also this whole system, the job that she's had and the life that she's kept holding onto has pushed them down, and now they're coming up. And one of the things that the film returns to time and again in a number of different ways is the idea that in this capitalistic system, for someone to succeed, someone else has to fail. For someone to have something, someone else needs to lose something. And that sort of zero sum, you know, it's all going to balance out in the wash. Feeling of it all is an inescapable factor in the movie. For someone to climb, someone else has to sink. And it layers the movie with a deep and intrinsic sadness from the moment it starts.
David, you saw this movie a while ago. In May, is there a part of it that's stuck with you in particular? Does this stand out as one of the best movies of the year?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I actually liked it even more upon second viewing. I think the first time you see it, you're more just excited about what is going to happen. And the second time I saw it a few months later, I could brace for a little bit more and really just sort of be with the characters, and the emotionality of it all hit me so much harder. The 25th hour, like, ending of what could have been, in this sort of alternate life, if things were different, that these people could have had, when you see Song Kang-ho, the great Song Kang-ho, emerging from the basement after, in this fantasy sequence, the son has, bought the house, which of course is impossible. You know, it's heartbreaking. And then we return to exactly the same place where the movie began, exactly the same shot composition, but where the family has been destroyed. One of the members has died. One is, you know, has taken the place of somebody else, again, to sort of cancel out that minus and positive minus charge. One of them is in jail. And yeah, I mean, it's It's devastating in that sense, but because of the anarchic energy that the scrappiness that Bong Joon-ho infuses to so many of his characters, I mean, a lot of the same energy you see in something like The Host, The Family of the Host, which Song Kang-ho is also in, is there, and it sort of disguises it all and blends all these genres together, where it really does feel like this madcap thing with elements of horror and all these other things, but like then you return to the core of sadness at the end of it, and that is really what stuck with me the second time around.
Yeah, the fun of it really makes the sad parts hit so hard. Katie, you were talking about the heist, watching them integrate themselves, become the parasites on this family. But I mean, one of my favorite sequences in the whole movie is kind of a reverse heist scene, when they start pigging out on all the food and then they realize they're about to be caught. And then everyone has to spread or get to different parts of the house. And whether they're going to get caught or not becomes such a heart racing experience.
That's so funny,
and,
too.
And then again, puts them in the position where they're like being oppressed, or they're the heroes who need to get out of this, and we're rooting for them to survive. But they've done something awful, and they probably should be caught. And I think that's the interesting contradiction of the movie. And I wonder what everyone here thinks about, like, what is Bong Joon-ho's ultimate message here? Is it just a lament for the people who can't get by, who would have to resort to this, that the system has forced them into this position? Or what is your major takeaway? I mean, the ending is so horrific, but
I think it's a lament for all the people that are just trapped in a system so deeply that, like, everybody does their best. Like, it's like, even when this movie, when we are thinking that they're going to get caught by the family, like, the tension of the movie at that point and how much we've gotten to know the Park family means that we know they're not going to be, like, you know, summarily execute them or anything. They're going to be, like, dismissed and publicly shamed. That's, like, the worst thing that could happen to them. So it seems like you develop, like, this low stakes situation where you could see all sides, and then what the movie reveals, like, at the end is that they're all in these weird power structures that they don't even see, like, especially the subservient ones at the end are all respect Mr. Park, either by yelling out respect or by, you know, basically doing like a little praying ritual to the Morse code button above his picture. So it is sort of like, or then like even for the fantasy sequence where it's basically like you need to buy your previous generation out of the basement. But like you said, Patches, that's impossible. But that doesn't mean that they don't have the dream. So mm-hmm. it is sort of like even the Parks are trapped and doing the best they can. Obviously our main family is trapped and doing the best they can. The poor maid, you know, is tried to do the best she could with her like husband that went stir crazy down in the basement, or, you know, just assumed his position in the basement of capitalism and made the best to do with it. So yeah, for me it is sort of like hope. It's a lament of the entire system. So for me, the shot that sticks out the most is towards the end when the apartment's flooding. The sister is just happy to find one dry cigarette, and she sits on top of the toilet as it's like spewing shit and like smokes her cigarette. She's just like, this is the lot in life. The toilet's gonna spew shit, and all you could do is sit on top of it and have like the little pleasures that you can. And that seems like what the movie was to me. I guess the thing that's also so amazing to me is having read more into it, since trying to like understand it, is these things like, the stone or the peaches all come from, Bong's life. Whereas, from a Western perspective, I read, like, you know, millstone around your neck, the biblical, like, reference is, like, the stone metaphor, or, like, dare I eat a peach from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is, like, you know, dare I mess up my face in front of these fancy people by enjoying, like, an actual fruit, like, those things becoming weaponized, but then also not being from those Western sources that I saw them, I think speaks to a lot of what Katie prognosticated about, like, this movie really plays because it world builds within itself, more successful than most capitalist commentary films do. Like, Sorry to Bother You had to get to horse people at the end before we, you know, really realized what it was trying to bluntly say. This one does, it like sneaks you in with a heist, but by the time it's over, I think any interpretation is at least one of the intended interpretations because it's just so precisely aimed at you.
When I saw it in Toronto, I wrote during the flooding scene in my notes, like, climate change, question mark? Thinking about how, you know, even now, it's low-lying, poor neighborhoods that tend to flood when in increasingly virulent weather system. Like, I don't know that that's something that was on Bong Joon-ho's mind, but it just feels very much there for the taking. And I don't think he would mind that as a message.
Well, no, but, you know, it's a classic high-low dichotomy and the stuff, the sewage, the shit always trickles down. And there's a reason why the rich family lives up on the hill. And this is a film that really strongly and consistently across all areas physicalizes the disparity between wealth and the position. And it turns this into a physical element. I mean, that's what Patches was saying about the design of the set. It's also meticulous and precise. And you sort of understand the way that half basement becomes what's the word I'm looking for? It starts with an L, liminal space between the two. It's really beautifully well done. I mean, Bong has been railing against inequality, financial inequality, social inequality for his entire career. It's most explicit in his least successful film, Snowpiercer, which is not a bad movie, but kind of messy compared to the rest of the stuff that he's done. But that is one where you can really see it again. And then you have, of course, Okja, where the corporate interests are running ramshod over the populace and the decency and the way they're treating these super pigs who they bred just to make another dollar. You can see it even in Memories of Murder, which is not necessarily geared towards that theme, but is sort of baked into the pie the way that people were not paying particular attention to the victims of the serial killer. And you can see it in all those movies, The Host is explicit and so on. But I think this is a really weaponized expression of some of the ideas that he's been wrestling with for a very long time. And it's just, you know, a society is only as powerful as, and it's as moral and whole as its most vulnerable people. And I think there's something very real and human about the way that they render the relationship between the two families in this movie, and don't write one off as the years of the victims, but sort of force them into all of the choices that they make. And it is a tragedy for me in the end, but certainly one you can have a very good time watching with an audience. And I don't think it proffers any sort of solution, but, you know.
Is there a reason maybe all of you guys have seen more Bong Joon-ho movies than I have. I've seen a handful. Do you think the reason that this is so successful compared to some of his other movies, especially like as a crossover hit, it's been a huge hit in Korea. Is it just because Parasite is better than his previous movies, or is there something about the timeliness? Like, what do you think accounts for why it's such a
phenomenon? I think it's a great movie. I think it's a better film than I like Okja a lot, but I do think it's a more holistic, coherent sort of sharper film than Okja, and I have my reservations about Snowpiercer, and those two films had the advantage, at least for the domestic market here in the United States, of having English being in English and then having American or English language movie stars. But Parasite had such a groundswell of critical support at Cannes. It won the Palme d'Or, which doesn't always
equal box office.
Right. But I think, you know, for a movie that already had so much goodwill on its side and such a groundswell of critical support and really did play to a broader audience, it certainly went a long way towards validating that support.
But I do think that the script is tighter and that the performances are really casual. They're so lived in. I was really astounded by the two kids. And kids, they're not children. I mean,
the children of the family.
Yeah, the children of the family. I mean, those two performances, and I love Song Kang-ho, but they really are so mesmerizing and so natural and have such chemistry together as they're doing this heist. They are really the linchpin of this, and certainly the sun in the end. But I also think it's just the evocative imagery, just putting the camera in the right places and have the luxury of building the sets we talked about. But even I was going to mention at the end, the sun, you know, he gets brain surgery at the end. And just wherever Bong Joon-ho put the camera on, whatever angle we're getting on, I couldn't stop. Maybe this is just what I think about whenever I see someone in a hospital in a movie anymore, but I'm just like, what is the bill going to be after this guy gets his brain surgery?
Well, that's the American version of this, where it's all about the cost of
care. But I think,
the American version of this movie is just really mean.
But I think images like that, just the way you were talking about climate change and the apartment flooding, seeing someone in that position after watching a movie where they don't have a dime, that resonates with people in a different way. This gets under your skin. And I love Bong Joon-ho's movies, but he's playing on his home turf here, and I think the images are just stronger than ever.
Also, shout out to the kid of the other family, the young boy who's just like the weirdo who runs around in an Indian headdress. And that's another metaphor that as an American, you're like, what does it mean? And you're like, maybe not what I'm trying to put on
it. He knew what the light was saying all along and never told anybody.
He's like R2-D2 of Parasite.
How dare he withhold that information?
I like that weird ass kid, but I agree that, you know, the 20 something kids are maybe the standouts along with Song Kang-ho.
Well, Parasite still in theaters, probably will be for a while.
I imagine it'll be playing for a long while. I think it's just now opened here last weekend, maybe the same in Denver. So it might be expanding to your city. That does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week. Hopefully I'll be there on time this time. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can comment and leave us notes. Is that where the new old feeds? No, that's on iTunes. Maybe that's someone else to mention.
Dave, I think.
You could find both the feeds under the subscribe, follow us always link at fightinginthewarroom.com.
These are the old classic episodes, if you want to go back. Okay, that's
Dad, remember what we thought about X-Men First Class and stuff.
Huntsman Winter War is the real, X-Men, like, wow.
No, X-Men First Class is definitely the movie that jumps to mind when I think of contentious early episodes of this podcast. And we were all sitting in my apartment on 2nd Avenue and 4th Street in a boiling hot room. In an apartment
drinking
that did
whiskey.
Eventually... Yeah, the apartment did later catch on fire. But that is unrelated, but it was mad hot. And tensions were flaring. I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. And self-appointed senior video game critic as of today. Please go read what I had to say about Death Stranding if you were at all interested about the game or about the intersection between movies and games. I spent 60 hours and 18 minutes playing it, and it makes me not above trawling for your eyeballs. Please leave us... You can find me on IndieWire at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. Please read us. Leave us a review. I will read them on the show.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name DA7E, which is also my Twitter handle. I do a podcast called The Storm, where we are rewatching Lost, and then we're going to talk about Star Wars. I'm going to get so nerdy on the Star Wars. So if you want to check it out, look for The Storm wherever fantastic podcasts are found.
And I'm Katie Rich. Even though I wasn't here for the Death Stranding conversation, I realized that maybe next time I'm in the same place as one of you, you guys can make me play one of these modern video games that I don't have access to. And don't understand.
Untitled Goose Game. She's going to play Untitled Goose Game.
Honk.
I feel like that is a lot easier to get into than Death Stranding.
Yeah, you need to like give me something that's like completely incomprehensible and like show me how to understand video games. Anyway, until that happens, you can find me at VanityFair.com on the Little Gold Man podcast, where we're talking about lots of Oscar season movies. And you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about what video game I should play or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
Actually, you know what, Katie, you answer this week's lightning round question, which was... In honor of Dr. Sleep, who is your favorite movie doctor?
The first one that came to mind was Dr. Doolittle, which isn't my real answer, but in the interest of ending the show, I'm going to go with it.
It's just
the Eddie Murphy Dr. Doolittle. Let the record show.
No, the Robert Downey Jr. one. I haven't seen it yet, but based on the trailer. We'll be back talking to you next week.
Ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Now I'm done. We're done.